even if you are a lone writer and you want to have like a consistent voice and tone across your documentation, I think it's best to reach out to other people in your company, like maybe marketing or product or even, you know, engineering, and align on those things, because it's a content strategy problem. Most technical writing at a software company is about gathering lots of information from different sources. Then, you know, you juggle those requests, you juggle all the information, all the data that you get. So you have to filter a lot. You have to decide what's valid knowledge, what's less, you know, necessary. And then you come up with something that is gonna work with the audience you're targeting. It's being that sort of bridge that I like technical writers to be.
Welcome to the API The Docs podcast. My name is Lara Wash. I'm the host today, and my guest is someone who published a love letter to technical writing. And I'm very, very happy that he accepted my invitation out of the blue, because we have never met, and he kindly humored me and came as a guest. So warmest welcome to Fabrizio Ferri Benedetti. Hi.
Hi there, Lara. Thank you for the invite. I'm glad to be here.
I'm very happy that you could join. How about we start with the naming reason behind your blog, Passo Uno, both the language and why those words?
Yeah, so Passo Uno, as I explained in the about section of my blog, stands for step one in Italian, because I'm Italian. I was born in Italy almost 41 years ago now. Even though I've been living in Spain since I was a kid, Italian is my mother tongue. And to me, it's like a pun, this name, because it's step one, you know, it's like the first step in a procedure, but it also means stop motion, you know, like the technique in cinema. And stop motion is like, for me, it's like a way of describing sometimes the how we do UX writing or how we do documentation, in the sense that we go step by step, you know, and then the end result is something that flows, a workflow, a movie, if you want.
What made you start blogging? And I understand that you didn't start your career as a technical writer in software, but you have a background in psychology, right?
Yeah, yes. I majored in cognitive psychology in Spain. And my intention was to become a researcher in academia. And I entered this PhD program in Valencia. And, you know, after a year, I found out that research wasn't really my thing. And not because of the, you know, the science aspect, the research, I love those. And I still carry some of the knowledge, some of the learnings in my current job. Like many other technical writers do. I know quite a few technical writers with a background in research. It's more the organizational and, you know, human resources management side of research that is almost non-existent in a way. Like, unless you're very lucky and end up in a strong research group, and even then, it's very hard to find like an environment where you can thrive while being respectful of your time, of your work-life balance. So yeah, it was just, you know, 1 year of research, and then I entered the private sector initially as a writer for a software portal.
And here we are, so many years later, with a love letter to technical writing.
Yeah, that was a fun piece. You know, it's one of those blog posts that I always wanted to write, and it's simply... It was unplanned, totally unplanned. And one day I felt like writing it, you know, and I was just thinking about my career. And usually the way, you know, this is could be interesting perhaps, but I don't have like a backlog of topics for my blog. So I don't plan too much ahead, like about the topics I want to write. Usually what it happens is that I engage in conversations in social media, for example, or at work, or, you know, in the Reddit Docs Slack channels, the community. And from those conversations stem sometimes some nuggets of an idea, some something that resembles like a, you know, a blog post. Maybe it's just a couple sentences. And then I take it, and when I have the time, I develop that into a full post. That's how I work. And that love letter to technical writing was born the same way. Like there must have been some conversations, maybe in social media, about why people choose technical writing as a career. And I ended up writing that love letter.
I don't know. For me, it was very heartwarming, especially reading it back now when even the earth is moving around ChatGPT. And especially the conclusion that you came to, that there's, I think you're quoting from some other people too, that we need more people on the inside of documenting systems. And I loved reading that.
That was a quote from Jeffrey Ventrella, who's a software developer from Silicon Valley. And I so agree, I so align with that quote, in the sense that, software companies need more people and less think people. And so more humanists, more teachers, more psychologists even, or, literature experts, writers, anything, any kind of role, as I explained in another post, can lead you to a technical writing position. And to me, the label technical writing is just like a temporary way of describing someone who is bringing that mindset to tech and to tech companies.
And what are the skills that you've been picking up recently, randomly or not randomly, prompted by others or by the challenges that you're facing?
Well, you know, technical writers, we're always learning on the job about new technologies. Like currently I'm digging into Kubernetes because it's a piece of technology that we work with, and I want to understand it better. And it's quite complex, but it's fascinating. Current skills, well, I'm digging recently into ChatGPT quite a lot, and I'm playing around with some software that's already open source out there, and playing with prompts, trying to get the this language model to learn a bit about documentation, our documentation, and see what comes out of it. And it's maybe not so much of a skill than curiosity. I'm very curiosity driven. Other skills, well, recently I'm also very much into continuous deployment, continuous integration, continuous deployment. So I've been looking a lot into Docker files to containerize our Doxus code environment, so that everyone can build a doc without having to worry about dependencies and installing like Python modules and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Are you doing this learning alone or in a large team or a smaller team? Or do you do like pair learning?
Well, it's usually I start alone. Like I usually onboard myself to stuff, and I love learning on my own. And then what happens is that I love to share what I learn with a larger group, either at work or outside. To me, the boundary there is not super defined. Like I see all writers as part of a big group, whether they are working with me or at another company. Like maybe it's a bit naive as a vision, but I think we can all share regardless of where we are currently working or writing. In this particular case, yeah, I've been learning alone, and sometimes I have some sidekicks and some colleagues who also want to learn these technologies, and we collaborate on some pull requests, and that's also pretty fun. Mm-hmm.
In your experience, is there aspects or toolings or tricks of specifically software documentation, technical writing, that is actually better if someone doesn't try to conquer the knowledge alone, but rather go at it in at least in pairs?
Well, voice and tone, or style guides, style in general, is something that shouldn't be done alone, I think. So even if you're a lone writer, you want to have like a consistent voice and tone across your documentation, I think is best to reach out to other people in your company, like maybe marketing or product or even, you know, engineering, and align on those things, because it's a content strategy problem. So it's not really it's not just technical writing skill or tip. It's a content strategy necessity to align everyone who creates content or who can contribute content around things like how the documentation talk to the user, or what terminology you use, or even what grammar rules sometimes, you know, for things like, it can be the tiny things like formatting of numbers, for example. And those things, they might seem like chores or very bureaucratic at times, because you are defining these little rules that they're very easy to forget sometimes. But I think they're also a very nice, they provide this chance of getting people together to talk about content in a company. So it's easy to see the value of aligning around style and voice and tone. So marketing, for example, is one of those departments that is usually very sensitive to these things in companies. And, you know, aligning around those things is a nice excuse to get together and get to know each other. So definitely not something to do alone.
We agreed that I'm not going to ask too much about your work, because I invited you not as a team representative, but as the one who wrote the blog posts. But still, let's not keep the audience hanging too much. So in what team do you work, and what is your role there that you've been playing?
I'm part of the Splunk documentation team. We're around 40-something writers, I think. It's a pretty big group for a tech company.
40?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. We are okay. You can count us in the tens. And then we are split in subgroups, depending on product lines. In my particular case, I work in the Observability Cloud Docs team. Observability Cloud is Splunk's observability solution for things like infrastructure monitoring, application monitoring, profiling, etc. And there I'm a senior staff tech writer in the team, taking care of the area that we call GDI, or Get Data In. It's a rather technical area where I get to document and learn a lot about OpenTelemetry, which is an open source software for observability, precisely.
When I was asking, well, specifically in the meetup, the WriterDocs meetup in Amsterdam, if we would get together just randomly, what would be the most to the point to talk about? Now, this was before ChatGPT, but it's still valid. Onboarding practices of, there's so much movement, obviously, lately, and also an escalating need for more and more technical writers who are able to orchestrate or document themselves software, which brings with it, especially in Europe, where I think we have very few dedicated university courses for this, let alone majors. So onboarding is, or training people who are not coming from technical writing majors, is a very present need. As a staff technical writer, do you play part in shaping your onboarding practices, and do you have some wisdom to share with others here? Or don't go there stories.
It's true that in Europe, there's, you know, very few courses at university level and even outside. I know a few. There is one in Spain, for example, that's been created like a couple years ago. The ITCQF, which is a Europe-based international certification for technical comms. So this is a very nice initiative, and we are seeing more and more of these in Europe, luckily. But more to your point, that's actually one of the things I would like to dig deeper into once I have a little more time, even maybe write something long form about it, to help fellow European tech communicators to especially lose the fear of technical writing. I don't think, like translators, for example, we have lots of translators in Europe for obvious reasons. And I think they're very well positioned to become technical communicators. They know the language. They know the nuances involved in translation, which already gives them like a very hands-on, applied, almost engineering-like knowledge of language, which is very necessary in technical communication. They usually, translators are not afraid of software. So it's a fantastic path for becoming a techcom professional. There are others, of course, but in general, the skills involved in becoming a technical communicator are not so complicated, or at least in my opinion, like it's not rocket science in a way. It's more, I think, the mindset and the attitude and the willingness to simplify things and to connect different parts of an organization to get things, to get content out that is easy to understand and useful. So for me, it's more about, it's not as much about learning as losing the fear of entering the tech comms field in Europe and other places that is not the Anglophone sphere. So the UK, or especially in the United States, this is a profession with hundreds, thousands of people working in software companies already, and other manufacturing companies, etc. It's been around for 50 years now there, but it's rather new in Europe. And I think making noise in social media like I do, or writing blog posts, for example, every time I speak to other technical writers in Europe, I always urge them to share their thoughts, to write blog posts or even short tweets about their work. And because I think it's important to just be visible. And once you reach maybe a critical mass there, I think we'll see more and more initiatives, even in the formal training field. But it's taking some time.
And under your tutelage, what is the evolution of tasks for someone you're training to become a technical writer? Someone who has the soft skills, has the affinity, but say, haven't even touched Kubernetes before. Where do you start? Because it is, it's very 0 to 100.
Yeah, the technology is simply, it's something contingent. It's not essential to onboarding someone. It could be Kubernetes, it could be virtual machines, it could be anything really. It wouldn't be the focus of my onboarding process.
What kind of tasks would you assign to lose that fear?
I still remember this on-site test I did when I started as a technical writer to start working at the company. And it consisted of, I really enjoyed it. It consisted of a number of information sources, like there were some Jira tickets, some email threads, some official documentation about a tool. And then, you had all this plethora of information sources, and in no particular order, with varying degrees of detail and quality. And the request was to create something for a particular audience, some concise documentation to do a particular task, targeting a particular audience. And I think those are the basic ingredients, I would say, of most technical writing at a software company. It's about gathering lots of information from different sources. Then you juggle those requests, you juggle all that information, all the data that you get. So you have to filter a lot. You have to decide what's valid knowledge, what's less necessary. And then you come up with something that is gonna work with the audience you're targeting. So it's being that sort of bridge that I like technical writers to be.
So there's already some retraining for translators, because there, you can't lose the information, and here you have to learn to filter for someone. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what do you think is working against this kind of learning? Why is it, apart from the staggering depth, non-ending depth of the technical knowledge that just doesn't stop going, why does technical writing have such a bad rap? Why do we need to blog more about it? Why is it so hard to get through?
Yeah, such a good question.
What's the thing that other roles would say, like, yeah, nice, but I'll never do that, never?
Well, I don't think this is complex, and I think there are several factors at play here. But first of all, I would like to challenge the assumption that that technical communication or technical writing is a bad rap. I would rather say that they don't have a rap at all. Like sometimes they're not on the radar. They're not visible. So there's this dimension of having this feeling of working alone or working in a field that nobody really understands. And it doesn't really help that for most people on Earth, especially outside of the US, technical writing maybe means like the dishwasher machine manual or, you know, the instructions for doing maintenance for your car, which are good examples, actually, of technical communication, but they're not particularly engaging, I would say. Like, people end up hating those artifacts. But they don't stop and think, like, that happens with translation as well. Like, there's lots of care, usually, put into technical translation, but people don't appreciate that. They don't see all the nuances, all the difficulties that go into creating technical documentation for a consumer product, for example, and then translating that into another language. And so for me, it's about building the reputation rather than changing it, because it's almost non-existent right now. That's my feeling. Like, I would love to, there's this blog post that I have in my backlog, actually, and it will take a time to develop, but I was thinking about technical writing in popular culture. And we don't have many examples. I think it's something, you know, worth researching, but there's not many instances of technical writers in pop culture. Like, you don't see a technical writer in movies, you don't see a technical writer in TV series, or even mentions of documentation. You know, it's not that common. It doesn't look exciting. But I think, you know, the same way we have seen doctors in TV series, and then we are seeing also teachers in TV series, and maybe one day we'll also see technical communicators in TV series. Why not?
Oh, I hope so. Oh, I could totally see that in some Korean drama about some high-tech fantasy they could bring in. There's some really good series where you see translators, so, and they really give the backstage view to the job, and I think that does a lot for a job, to show the practical reality of doing something. Yeah, you're right.
Maybe. Yeah, I think so. It's, well, of course, TV and movies always oversimplify things, right? But they also help turn something into a popular profession or a popular activity. And even if those examples in popular culture don't exist, then I think we can suggest, you know, media producers or journalists or whoever is creating content for the masses to think about us. And I wrote this tweet a few weeks ago where I said, heroes read the manual. That's how I picture, like, you never see a hero reading a manual in Star Wars, but pretty sure that if you created like an extended version, you would see Han Solo reaching to the manual of the Millennium Falcon, and that would be great.
Where do you see yourself evolving, if I may ask?
If you factor in GPT and all the AI evolution happening right now, I see myself becoming, if I continue being an individual contributor in tech companies, I see myself be transitioning more and more towards editing rather than writing. And I think that there's like two big forces pushing, I think, everyone doing technical writing right now towards editing. One is, starting from the most recent, one is AI-assisted writing, in the sense that I think writing as a chore, writing as something you have to do in order to achieve other goals, will benefit from the assistance of big language models like GPT. And that doesn't mean we'll be replaced by artificial intelligence by no means. And I wrote a couple blog posts where I say the opposite, where I say that if anything, AI will augment our capacities and make us more productive. But there's room there to become like a curator of AI-produced content, for example. And that will still be necessary. Like the human touch there is about not so much about writing like a specific tutorial, but like understanding where that piece of content could fit into a wider information architecture. That, I think, is still out of the scope of artificial intelligence. The other big push is coming from DevRel and DocSys community, or DocSys ecosystem, as I recently read from other authors in social media, in the sense that everybody now is able to create or contribute content for software documentation, for example. It doesn't happen very often, but for very popular products, you see lots of contributors going to GitHub and editing little pieces of documentation, adding topics, etc. So there also, you can have maybe a few editors at a company and have the hive mind or the community move the bulk of the content production. So, you know, the editor or the content strategies, if you want, is definitely a position where I see myself transitioning if those two trends continue developing and gaining strength. Mm-hmm.
Is that also appealing to you, to become more editor than writer?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's, especially in this age of information overload, there's definitely lots of value in filtering and selecting and improving, enhancing raw content for whoever is going to consume it. So I see that definitely as valuable as writing.
If I, as a technical writer, feel my contribution in my empathy with the readers, then as an editor, even more so. Yeah. Well, almost a year. You published it last summer, if I'm not mistaken, post about on how you see documentation, API documentation, if I'm not mistaken, specifically evolving. And what kind of metrics would you recommend for each of these evolutionary steps? And I wanted to ask, where did this come from? Why did you feel the need to write this? And I loved reading it, and thank you for writing it.
Well, this already, you know, was born as a conversation on Twitter, where essentially I was wondering about, together with other people, about what makes documentation complete. And this is something difficult to define in most cases. And the answer to me is not, there is no clear-cut, you know, criteria for saying docs are complete when you get here. Because there are several levels, in my opinion, of docs completeness or docs quality. And they're all fine. And it's, you know, it's fine to just stay at one level. Since you were talking also about API documentation, this reminds me of restfulness, you know, the restful levels in APIs. Like an API can be at restful level 2 and use resources, and maybe it doesn't have hyperlinks or anything fancier than that, but it can still be a good API. And documentation might just focus on completeness and being factually correct. And perhaps it doesn't have the most exciting layout, but it's also fine, you know, to stay there. So I think my attempt with that blog post with the, you know, the hierarchy of needs for documentation, which was, and again, a psychological pun. I think my psychological training always surfaces in unexpected ways like that. What I was trying to do there was to provide several good landings for documentation. Like it's just, there's no single criteria of success. You can be successful at several stages in several ways, sometimes even concurrently. And that's also, I also caution people in that post that things don't have to happen sequentially. Like maybe you're focusing on two aspects at once. You're focusing on the look and feel and the completeness of content. And even though, you know, look and feel is usually should be perhaps one of the last thoughts about documentation, at least in, you know, from my point of view. So that's, you know, instead of having just one port of call, you have five. You have five places where you can say, well, I got here and I think we can consider our doc successful. And, you know, to each of those levels in that blog post, I suggested some metrics. But metrics is also still one of those aspects that is very, very tricky to unravel.
Yeah. So the last season of API the Docs was about this, and not necessarily theoretically, but okay, from the trenches. And we heard some interesting things. In your experience, what widely used metrics are tripping people up the most?
I think we look too much at Google Analytics. It's one of the few tools at our disposal. You know, it's easy to set up. It's relatively easy to use, although it can get really complicated depending on what you want to do. But the weakest side of Google Analytics is that it's been mostly designed around marketing funnels. So, you know, you want to check whether a piece of content leads to conversion. Like, is people buying this product or is people accomplishing this action? And that's difficult to do if docs are separated from the product. So analytics makes sense when, for instance, you have in-product documentation. Like, you have maybe a wizard, you know, a guide, a setup guide that leads you through a complicated process. And there you can measure completion, of course. But if you don't have that sort of integration with the product, the meaning of page views or bounce rate or, you know, is very, very weak. I think it's even counterintuitive. Like, it's actually good to have a high bounce rate for a tutorial because it means that people found what they needed in that page and didn't need to go anywhere else, for example. And so aside from that, I think it's something that we don't do that often is qualitative research. I think it's good to focus on quantitative metrics, of course, but before getting there, I think it's worth checking with real users how your documentation is performing.
Mm-hmm. Do you have some good experiences with that?
Yeah, I've been doing user research, both at New Relic and Splunk in the past. And we are still doing user research at Splunk. It's, you know, it's a very exciting project. And there's so many insights you get from asking people in, you know, in your field about your documentation that you would never get using a quantitative tool or instrument. Like, for example, I remember this case where we got this user to open the docs, and I was, you know, recording the session and the user was sharing their screen. And I noticed that they were using a dark mode plugin in Chrome. And I was like, okay, this is the first time I see my documentation in dark mode. I didn't even think of trying this, but actually this is a thing. This is something that people do, and you can't actually capture that in Google Analytics. You don't know whether they're using dark mode or not. And so that already brought a number of ideas about improvements we could apply to the style sheet of our site. And then, yeah, it's, you know, is all those little things people stumble upon, or even just the way they scroll, observing that is fascinating. And the sample size don't need to be that big. Like, it's Nielsen Group, I think, estimated around 5 to 10 people is enough for a user research study.
When you do such a thing, and I guess right back at your research roots, how do you scope the bite you take with your questions for a small group?
Well, I try applying progressive disclosure to the process. And this, again, reminds me of my time as a psychologist. So, you know, you start from exploring, you know, the maybe like a documentation set or a section, and you see how users react to it. And then you provide a simple instruction, like try to accomplish this operation using the docs, for example. Or there was this other study where I created a Docker container with the tool that we document so that the users could run it and try to configure it using our documentation. So the task was simple. And then after they tried to accomplish the task, there were a number of questions about how was your experience, or where did you stumble upon, or you know what sort of difficulties you encountered. So it's about digging progressively deeper, but starting from something very simple, because users start also from something that is apparently deceivingly simple, like I want to do X. But then, you know, they land on the documentation and they discover that it's not that simple.
Exactly. What are the things that you experience that you need to work towards in a roundabout way? There's an expression for that that avoids me right now. Things that you can never reach directly. So as a technical writer, most of the things are quite straightforward to reach, unless it's about getting the subject matter expert to engage with you long enough. But are there targets that you answer for that cannot be reached directly, but you have to go round?
It depends on the, you know, on the company setup, on how your organization works. But in general, I think in software, there are a number of things that are difficult to reach, not impossible to reach, but they're difficult to reach for technical writers. One of them is testing certain scenarios. And that's, like I always recommend that technical writers test software themselves. And it's a fantastic way of onboarding yourself to new technology. So if you have an API, you know, ask for an API token and, you know, set up Postman, try some calls, etc. But other more complex scenarios might require like spinning an entire cluster of servers. And, you know, trying to configure that is usually out of reach for technical and budgetary reasons. So there you have to necessarily rely on secondhand knowledge. Other things that are difficult to reach are, you know, like other areas of the business might be producing content that might not be entirely aligned with what you're doing. And, you know, and usually those areas do not use DOCSIS code. Like you have maybe to use Adobe Experience Manager or similar content management systems that are pretty closed. And there is about, you know, trying to establish, set up good relations within the company with those content creators. But this, again, is a content strategy problem. It's not just a technical writing problem. You have to, you know, create those alliances with other people who creates content so that the flow for the user is seamless. Unfortunately, it's not always the case, but you know, you can't just change all the content. It would be fantastic if you could change all the content with a, you know, by snapping your fingers. Like, oh, I want to change the UI text and the marketing material and the documentation and even the code comments, you know, in one sweep. But that takes time. But that's also usually what has the most impact as a technical writer. It's one of the things that you can do that have the most impact.
As a closure, we usually ask our guests, what are the advice or message in a nutshell you would want to leave the listeners with? But you have shared so much advice. Let me turn this around for you. What is the question you would like to leave the listeners to sit with?
So it's two questions, really. There's two questions I would like to ask the listeners and really anyone who works in our field. The first is, why do you want to be a technical writer? And, you know, in many cases, we end up in this field by chance. It happened to me also. But I think that even after having worked for years as a technical writer, many of us, you know, never formulate that question and try to answer that question. And I think it's important to go over it and try to come up with an answer that is good for you. You know, it provides purpose and it provides direction. And I think that's very helpful to have. And the second question, well, it's more of an advice, really, rather than a question. I think the other piece of advice is, especially when we talk about developer portals, is don't panic. Don't, Yeah, it's. I think it's very, very easy, especially in developer documentation, to fall into the trap of the imposter syndrome. Because most of us are not developers or have very limited experience as developers, but we are writing for them and we're writing, you know, developer content, and it's very easy to think we are not doing a good job. But you have to think this, just by trying, you're already improving things. And I think that's the mantra that should guide us when creating developer portals and developer documentation.
Wholeheartedly agreeing with that. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Fabrizio, for being our guest. And I'm looking forward to meeting you in person, wherever that will happen.
Likewise.
And this was a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And looking forward to your blog posts in the future.
Will do.
Thank you for listening to the API the Docs podcast. We thank our colleagues at Pronovis Developer Portals for letting us work on this, and the entire API community for all of the mutual support and sharing of experiences that you give each other. Do you have a topic or guest that you would like us to spotlight? Drop a note at podcast@pronovix.com. If you go to the website apidocs.org, you can find the recaps and recordings of past API the Docs conferences, as well as the upcoming program. Until next time, be well.